possible in the Bible. Verse 13, chapter 20, verse 13, page 73 of Exodus. You shall not murder. You shall not murder. Now, I guess you might have noticed that as we've gone through the commands, the first five, or the first four certainly, have been very much about our relationship with God. The first command, have no other gods before me. The second command, do not make any idols. The third command, don't take my name in vain, says God. The fourth command about worship, the Sabbath day. The first four are looking upwards to God. Five is a bit of a transition. We're looking upwards, but not to God now. We're looking upward to our parents. And then from then onwards, the second half, often called the second table of the law, commandments 6 through 10 are horizontal, at least at first glance. They're about our relationship to other people. And on the whole, this is just a way of remembering them. It's not sort of deep theological truth. But on the whole, the way to remember them is they get gradually less severe in their effect on other people. Now, it doesn't mean they're not important. But if you look at them, number 6, murder. You can't do anything worse to someone than murder. Number 7, adultery. Number 8, steal. Number 9, bear false witness. So get them into trouble through your tongue. And number 10, covet. It's a bit of a rough and ready rule, but if you're trying to remember how to learn them, roughly they drop in severity, at least a physical impact on our neighbours. So today, murder. And it's the kind of command that if you were reading it in the morning, if it was your morning quiet time, that was the verse set for the day, I guess we could read it and think pretty quickly, yeah, okay. It's got the sort of, just the slight whiff of being a bit of an irrelevant command for us, hasn't it? When I was at Duffield, where I was assistant minister, I was preaching on a completely different topic, and I said to Mark, who was the minister before the service, one of the things I found hard about preparing the talk was that I couldn't imagine there was really anyone in this congregation who would commit this particular sin. He said, never, ever assume that any sin is beyond any person, and he is yet to serve in a congregation where there is a sin outlined in the Bible that hasn't been committed. And so this command, do not murder, it's not a command for the Bronx, it's not a command for Somalia and sort of war-torn North Africa, it's a command for us. And I can say that actually, amongst us today, and I did get permission before saying this, I ought to ought to say, but there is someone who has committed murder. I'm not going to tell you who, but I did ask permission, I don't just dob people in, there is someone who has committed murder. So I say that really so we don't think this is just something beyond us. Okay, this is just something for people out there. It is, of course, a serious sin. Okay, doesn't take much explanation, does it? Doesn't need much justifying. It is a serious sin. The actual word, if you look down, has a little four at the end of it, a little footnote number four. And hopefully the editors of this particular edition of the Bible give a bit of sort of explanation to the word murder. They tell us that the word also covers causing human death through carelessness or negligence. Notice the command isn't do not kill. That's not the command. Sometimes we that's what we think, do not kill. That's not the command. The command is do not murder. Now, there's a reason for that. And the reason is that under certain circumstances in the Bible, certain people, are allowed to kill. If you just flick over the page to chapter 21 of Exodus. Chapter 21 and verse 12. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. What do you do with a murderer, says God, so that to the Israelites? Will you kill him? Is that hypocrisy? Is God ordering one person to break his command he'd just given a few verses earlier? In fact, a command he'd given in that very verse? Well, of course not. God, at least to the Israelites, you remember in the Old Testament, the people of God were one nation living in one place, and there was no division between their nationality and their faith. Okay, the two were twinned together in a way that's not true for us now. But at least in those days, God did institute capital punishment. And if you've ever read through the Old Testament, you'll know there are all sorts of crimes that God gives the death penalty for. Of course, this is in the days before DNA evidence or fingerprinting. But still, God instituted the death penalty. Now, that's not where we're going today. It would at least give us pause before we sort of say, oh no, it's a horrific thing. But I'm certainly not going to start arguing either for or against it this afternoon. The point is that some killing was allowed in the Old Testament. In that circumstances, it was judicial. Okay, it wasn't allowed, all right, for me to just go and kill someone. If someone was found guilty, well, one of the punishments could be killing. Similarly, in war, under certain circumstances, war was justified. And again, if you've read the Old Testament, you'll know that in very specific circumstances, when God himself directed it, war was allowed. I think it's fair to say, similarly today, it is not an unchristian thing to be a soldier. It is an unchristian thing to be a murderer or an assassin. It is not a problem necessarily at all to be a soldier. When John the Baptist interacts with some Roman soldiers at the beginning of Luke's Gospel, and they come and say, you know, how should we repent? He doesn't say, well, you should stop being a soldier. Even though they're serving the Roman army, hardly the most sort of virtuous army ever. In the book of Acts, we get Cornelius, the centurion, as one of the early converts, probably the first Gentile convert. And again, we're never told that he was told to give up his life as a centurion. War obviously can be wrong. There are unjust wars. It is never something to be sought after or entered upon lightly. But most Christian thinkers, most Christian readers of the Bible have thought that under certain circumstances, an obvious one being defence, for instance, it is okay to fight. If you're going to fight, you will kill. So that's why it's important that we see this word. It isn't just killing, but murder. Okay, the deliberate, unlawful taking of someone's life. Otherwise, we're going to see the whole Bible as full of contradictions if we just think it outlaws all sorts of killing. It is slightly broader than murder, as that little footnote helps us understand. It would kind of also include what we might call manslaughter. More or less, a bit of a generalisation, but more or less in English law, if you deliberately kill someone, it's murder. If you kill someone having not intended to, it's manslaughter. So the same word that is translated murder in You Shall Not Murder, a bit later in Exodus, is used of someone who's chopping with an axe, and the axe head flies off and hits someone and kills them. Will they have, in that circumstance, killed using this kind of word? Because they've not been careful enough, they've not looked after their equipment. So it's sort of negligent killing. So when God says, do not murder, he is being narrower than killing, but not quite as narrow as deliberate ending of life. And yet that's where I want to focus today, the deliberate ending of another human being's life. That sort of manslaughter case is a bit more complex and not, I think, for us now. There are two reasons why we're told not to murder. I think two sort of underlying principles that hold this truth together. They're the building blocks on which do not murder is built. And the first is that human beings are made in the image of God. Okay, human beings are made in the image of God. We know that, don't we, from Genesis 1. We didn't just sort of evolve accidentally out of the slime. We were made, and made in the image of God. And that would mean, of course, that any attack on a human being is also a kind of attack on his image. I think I might have used this example before, but when the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, reached its culmination and Hussein was brought down, many people in many of the cities attacked posters of Saddam Hussein. They couldn't get the man himself, he was hiding, no one knew where he was, so they pulled down posters, and most famously that giant statue of him that was toppled down. It was sort of their way of attacking Saddam Hussein, even though they couldn't get at him, literally. And similarly, when we attack another human being with an intent to harm him, we're attacking someone who is bearing God's image. That's one of the reasons it's so serious. It's not just an attack on humans, it's also an attack on God. So the first sort of truth, that the building block, is that we're made in God's image. The second is that we are therefore owned by God. Everybody is owned by God. Christians, in an extra special way, I suppose, have been bought back, but everybody belongs to God. And what that means is your body is not your own. We think of our bodies, that this is mine. I've got the right to do with my body what I want. They are my hands. It is my mind, my brain. It is me. But actually, God says, no, I gave it to you. What did you do to bring yourself into the world? Nothing. What do you do to keep yourself alive? Can you actually keep your own heart beating? Can you keep your own lungs pumping? No, life comes from me. Everything we have is on loan. We are someone else's property, God's property. And so if I attack either someone else or myself, I am actually damaging, attacking God's property. I do not have the right to do that. Now, that means, of course, I don't even have the right to end my own life. Now, one of the difficulties this afternoon is a command about murder and killing leads us into all sorts of very difficult and emotional areas. And each one in its own right, you know, you could spend a long time on. And I was half tempted just to ignore the difficult situations because for fear of being pastorally insensitive. What I want to do is mention them and acknowledge right at the start that there is more complexity than I can possibly deal with it in 20 minutes or so. But if we don't mention them, then actually the danger is they always go under the radar and we don't realise they're serious. So first of all here, in terms of taking our own lives, you'll know there's lots of debates at the moment about what essentially is euthanasia. Deciding at the end of someone's life, maybe at their own hand or at the hand of their family, that it's okay to end their life. People going abroad to clinics on the continent where it is allowed, in England it's not, thank God, to end their lives. Now, of course, we have compassion for people who are in that kind of suffering. My grandma died 2 or 3 weeks ago now. And the last few weeks, it's horrible to see when people get that frail where they don't have any quality of life. Part of you, if you're honest, much as you love the person, does want them to die. You want them to be out of pain. But we do not have the right to end our own lives. Because it is not my life. It is God's life. It is God's body. I cannot stop a heart deliberately that belongs to Him. Now, it's not the same as saying that we always must do everything to keep someone alive. Of course, sometimes we might decide, well, that's enough. That's enough treatment. And in fact, that's what happened with Grandma. Eventually, my mum and my aunt said, no, don't resuscitate her. And I don't think at all that is a breaking of this commandment. Death was coming. It was on the way. And sadly, and tragically, but I think rightly, they let it take its course. They didn't put her through all sorts of artificial prolongings of life. That is not a breaking of the commandment. Now, of course, there are going to be some really difficult situations you can't possibly solve with sort of standing at the front and preaching. They'll need prayer and wisdom in the details. But the big picture is that we must resist any attempts to legalise the taking of our own lives because they are not our lives. At the other end, and I'm afraid this also is a difficult and a painful one, but at the other end, of course, it's just a fact that the most dangerous place to be in Britain is in the womb. Every year, more or less, that the numbers have fluctuated, but since about 2000, it's in the region of 200,000 abortions. The Department of Health statistics, they released it in 2009, so 2 or 3 years out of date now, said that 99% were for psychological and social reasons, i.e. it's not that if this abortion didn't go ahead that the mother might die, it's not that sort of crisis case. It is that the baby wasn't wanted because it would make the mother psychologically damaged afterwards. Or often, in all honesty, it would make socially life difficult. Now again, this is one we've got to be incredibly careful, and there are all sorts of difficult circumstances, of course. But those statistics, about 200,000 a year. 1967 was the first year that abortion was legalised, and the following year there were about 20,000 abortions. 20,000 to 200,000 in the last 40 years or so. That is an astronomical number of deaths. The other frame, sort of little building block we probably need in there, is worth mentioning, is that in the Bible's view of things, life begins at conception, not at an arbitrary stage thereafter. In Psalm 139, David says, you knit me together in my mother's womb. In Psalm 51, he says that, surely I was sinful even from the day I was conceived. In Luke's Gospel, we read of John the Baptist, who, when he's still in the womb, when his mum hears about Jesus, John the Baptist and Jesus are cousins, and when Mary, Jesus' mum, goes to her cousin, Elizabeth, and says, I'm pregnant too, and it's going to be Jesus, in the womb, John the Baptist, who's there, we're told he sort of leaps. It's as if he's spiritually born again before he's actually physically born. And of course, when the angel Gabriel tells Mary that the Holy Spirit will come upon you and you'll conceive, that is the moment the Son of God entered the world. Jesus in the womb is a person. If you follow any of the kind of debates that go on, you might have realised that recently there's been a shift. It used to be that people tried to use science as an argument against this. They would sort of try and claim that science said you're not really a human being in the womb until, well, it would be a fairly arbitrary point. Recently the debate has shifted because people have had to acknowledge that at the moment of conception you have all your chromosomes, all your DNA, all the genetic material you're going to have. So scientifically, if you like, everything is there from conception. And so the ground the debate has shifted to is debate over whether you can be a human being, sort of a creature, without being a person. And if you look on Newsnight or any of the more slightly more academic debates, the debate tends to be that you're not really a person until perhaps you can feel pain. You're not a human being until you can reason, use your brain. And that's led the most sort of militant atheists, who don't obviously have any understanding of, or belief rather, in a spiritual life, to actually say that if you're born and have mental difficulties, that if you are not ever going to have your full mental faculties, it's all right to kill a baby even outside the womb. Peter Singer, he was at Princeton, so it's not some sort of extremist in the corner. Princeton University, the kind of Oxford and Cambridge of America, he argued that. Actually, for an atheist, it's a very logical argument. If we're just a bag of cells and not going to be much use to the species, well, why not? God says, no, actually, you're special. You're made in God's image. You're owned by him, whether you're vastly intelligent or not at all intelligent, whether you're full able-bodied, whatever that might mean, or not. And there is dignity in every human life. No matter how human beings might judge them. And that is why, again, gently and carefully, and probably with tears in many circumstances, and with much love, Christians do have to stand the ground on this abortion debate. It is not right. As with any sin, and we will come back to this, as with any sin, it is also not unforgivable. There is a particular guilt that can accrue for those who have gone through an abortion. But God's forgiveness, God's grace, God's washing, God's cleansing is not stopped by any sin. There is nothing too serious for him to forgive. The way, if you do feel this weight of guilt, and again, statistically, it's got to be that there are many Christians who have gone through this themselves. But the way to find peace again, if you're racked with guilt, is not to try and keep telling yourself it is not a sin, I haven't done anything wrong. Because unfortunately the truth would always just keep plugging away at you. You won't get a quiet in your conscience. The way to peace is to yes, acknowledge you've done something wrong. But actually to come to God, his grace and forgiveness, it is there for all. End of life, beginning of life. All of it is important to God. And at neither end can it be terminated. Now those are the real big issues, if you like, the difficult debated areas that I wanted to touch on. But the danger is, when we look at this commandment, and particularly because there are these sort of issues floating around, the danger is that is the only place that we focus our attention. And what it can do, which is exactly what the Pharisees did in the New Testament days, it can mean that we draw this sort of circle of baddies and goodies. Baddies are the people who are pro-euthanasia, or pro-terminating life, or pro-abortion, or whatever it might be. And goodies are the people who are against it. All the people who have never killed anyone. So when Jesus comes along, what he does is say to the Pharisees, look, you have completely misunderstood the law. He doesn't say to them, it's actually deeper now, I'm going to change it. He says, you've misunderstood it. There's far more to being a murderer than just literally killing a physical human being. Flick on with me to Matthew chapter 5. And this is Jesus preaching on the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, page 977. Remember the setting of the Ten Commandments. The Israelites have come out of Egypt, they've crossed the desert, they've crossed the Red Sea, and then they've gone up to this mountain, Mount Sinai. Clouds have come down, and Moses has started preaching from the top and brings down the Ten Commandments. In Matthew's Gospel, what do we get? We get the story of Jesus coming out of Egypt, We get the story of Jesus being baptized in the Jordan. We get the story of Jesus going into the desert to be tempted. And then what's the first thing he does? He goes up a mountain to teach. He's deliberately sort of copying what happened to the Israelites. Egypt, desert, water crossing, up the mountain. He's saying, look, this is the new way, the deep way, the real way of obedience to God. And when he turns his mind to the commandment, verse 21, you shall not murder, he actually explains it's much deeper. So verse 22, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. There's a way of killing people, says Jesus, with your tongue. You don't have to use a knife or a bullet, sticks or stones. You can kill with your tongue. You can do it face to face, can't we? Where we lash out at someone. We have a real go at them, insult them to their face, tell them how much we hate them. Use every sort of filthy word that comes to mind. We're like a boxer. We go head to head, right in at them, going to bang them and bang them and bang them, tell them what we really think of them until they're down on the ground. That is murder, says Jesus. There's another way of doing it. It's more like a sniper. We're sort of hidden in the undergrowth, and basically the person never knows. We perhaps assassinate them to someone else. You'll never guess what so-and-so did. Phil, he's such a dot, dot, dot. And behind the person's back, with them never knowing, unbeknownst to them, they're walking around happy in the world. We are killing them behind their back. The tongue can be an instrument of murder. But actually, it goes even further. Verse 22, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. even anger that is in the heart is like murder. Just flick on again to 1 John, not John's Gospel, but 1 John, almost at the end of the Bible. Page 1229, and John, the disciple of Jesus, picks up this theme. And if anything, he goes even further, even deeper into the commandments. 1229, John, sorry, 1 John, chapter 3, and verse 15. Just so this is crystal clear to us. 1 John 3:15, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. If you hate someone in your heart, you're a murderer, says John. If you watch Star Wars, or even if you haven't, you might have seen the famous scene where Darth Vader gets fed up with one of his generals, and he just sort of looks at him and sort of puts his hand like this. And even though there's no physical contact, just the power of Vader's force kills him. This poor guy is literally choked to death. If you could kill with your thoughts, if every time you thought evil of someone, they dropped dead, wouldn't we be in trouble? There'd be an awful lot of dead bodies around, wouldn't there? If every time an evil thought sprang into our mind, that person dropped. The youth group I had back in Duffield would have been pretty small, pretty quickly. Thoughts are not irrelevant. Earlier on I said that there was a murderer, someone who committed murder here in the congregation. Who is it? Well, it's me. Now, some of you will have sort of guessed that from the start. Others of you will be thinking, okay, you know, trick, little preaching trick or whatever, very good. But if you're thinking, well, come on, not really, then actually you've not understood this verse. There isn't a body buried in the back of Lever Street. But, verse 15, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. A murderer. If you're thinking, look, it's not that serious. What John says to us, it is massively serious. It's a breaking of the sixth commandment. It is murder, just thoughts, just hatred. It may not be sort of expressed in horrible language because we're Christians and we've sort of purified our tongue a little bit. But just deep down in our hearts, if we're thinking, I wish you weren't here. It is murder. Legalists, Pharisees. Actually, we think of them as the kind of people who like laws. Yeah, the Pharisees are the kind of people who want to have all sorts of laws to obey. Actually, what legalists do is lower the bar. They lower the bar. They don't raise it. The Pharisees lowered the bar because they want to be able to step over it. They want to be able to say, yes, we've done this. So for a Pharisee, murder is simply murder, you know, ending the life physically. Jesus and his disciples know it is much, much, much higher than that. Evil words, murder with the tongue, evil thoughts, murder with the heart, they are still murder. Of course, if you drop the bar, you don't need to live by grace. You don't need to come to God for forgiveness. You don't need his power to not commit these things. You can sort of do it on your own. Most of us can avoid physically killing people. But that is not where God sets the bar. But why is it so serious? It's sort of John's overdoing it. You know, everyone who thinks evil in his heart is a murderer. Why is he doing it? Why does he raise the stakes so much? And in fact, why does Jesus say that just for evil words to people, you can go to hell? And his words were calling someone "you fool." I imagine most of us have called people worse than "you fool" in our life. Why is it so serious? Well, remember those two truths we had right back at the beginning, that people are made in God's image and owned by God. Made in God's image and owned by God. And what that means is when I'm thinking, "I wish you weren't here," when I'm chuntering against this person in the heart, to be honest, even if they have done things wrong, okay, it doesn't make it okay just because everybody's a sinner. Of course the person who you're fed up with will have mistreated you at some point. We're not meant to live, we can't live in a world purely of pure people, can we? So even when you're fed up with someone who is being an idiot, even then, when we hate them in our hearts, what we are saying to God is, it would be better if that person who you made in your image was just not around. If I was running the world, God, I'd do things differently. You have messed up here, God. This is unreasonable. What we're saying is, I would do a better job of running the world, God. What are we doing? Well, we're trying to climb up and push God off the throne and put ourselves on. And of course, that's exactly what we did do when Jesus came into the world. When God himself comes into the world, what do? We do kill him. That's the story of the Gospels, isn't it? God comes in. Are we pleased to see him? Oh, great, finally you're here. No, we kill him. We get rid of him. All that's happening to those people who were there at the time, his contemporaries, the ones who literally nailed him to the cross, all that's happening is they were the particular people who happened to bump into him face to face. We would have done the same if we'd had the chance. They are not the bad generation, the Duff batch. Jesus had come just 100 years later, well, it would have been fine. Of course not. If Jesus came to Derby in 2012, we'd have got him. We'd have got him. Because we are murderers in our hearts. And yet he forgives. Take Jesus. When he came into the world, he knew he was going to be murdered. All the way through his life, he was just moving towards his assassination. And it's not just that he went through with it. I mean, that would be pretty impressive. It's not just that he sort of gritted his teeth and got through it. It's actually that, well, he enabled it. Hebrews tells us that it is Jesus who keeps the world going. It is he who sustains, to use Hebrews' language, the universe. So what it means is that as Judas was born, Jesus was sustaining him. Now, Jesus knew what Judas would do, but it is Jesus who sustained Judas's mother through childbirth, who protected Judas through life right up to the moment he betrayed him. It is Jesus who knew the centurion that would crucify him, who got him promoted through the ranks, who protected him in any battles he might have fought that far, and brought him to that moment, even though he knew that it would result in his own death. It is Jesus who oversaw Pontius Pilate's political career so that he would eventually be promoted from Rome, sent out to Judea, made governor, and ultimately convict him. It is not that Jesus just went ahead knowing that he'd have to face death. It's actually that Jesus was kind and loving to all these people, giving them families, giving them lives. Kind to the very people who would kill him. Even on the cross, what did he pray? Father, forgive them. Father, forgive these murderers. Why? Because he does love. His love is so great that it's not just a love to people who love him, it is a love to people who hate him, who want to kill him. And that involves you and me. Jesus loves murderers, which means Jesus loves you. Whatever you've committed, whether it's one of the sort of physical sins we touched on at the beginning, or whether it is sins of the heart or the tongue, he still loves you. Even though in a deeper level there were attacks on him, he still loves you. He still will forgive you. And ultimately, he won't just forgive you. He will change you. In Romans 6, we're told that when Christ died, we died. When Christ died, we died. So that means that as Christ was murdered, actually, if you're a Christian, if you're a believer, because you're united to him, you were murdered too. You were murdered too. It was before you were born. You weren't there physically, but spiritually, somehow you were united to him. Paul says this: we know that our old self was crucified with him. So we were murdered with Jesus. Why? Second half of the verse, Romans 6:6. So that the body of sin might be brought to nothing, so we would no longer be slave to sin. When we died, when we were murdered, spiritually united to Jesus, what was being killed? Well, not the real you. You weren't being destroyed. What was being killed was the old you, the sinful nature. All the part of you that wants to murder and hate and attack with the tongue, that was killed at the cross. It's not just that he's paying the punishment, it's somehow the very power of it. It's hard to sort of express it, really, but the very power that turns you into a murderer was killed at the cross, says Paul, so that we'd no longer be slaves to sin. God forgives our murdering hearts, but he also enables us not to have them anymore. And that's why his advice in Romans 8 is to become a murderer again. Romans 8 and verse 13. By the Spirit, put to death the body. By the Spirit, put to death. Kill. It's the word again, it's that murder word. Kill the deeds of the body, the sinful nature, of course. What Jesus has enabled you to be is a murderer, not of other people or of God, but of your sinful nature. And that's what he calls you to. He's enabled you to do it and called you to it. This applies really to all the commandments. We've done it with murder, we could have done it with any of the others. As a person who is in relationship with Christ, it doesn't now mean that I simply sit back and wait for heaven. What he's enabled me to do is kill sin. It is an active thing. Kill it by the Spirit, he says. I take it that means that we think of promises from the Bible and bring it to fight our sinful hearts. Do not sin now, because if I don't, the reward will be great in heaven. Do not sin now, because my Heavenly Father has enabled me not to. I take it means we rely on prayer. We don't try and get through a day without prayer, because we know that we will revert back to our old selves, but instead we kill sin. Jesus enabled you to be a murderer of your sinful nature. In fact, he has called you to. And verse 13, what does he say? If you do it, you will live. If you do it, you will live. It's not that that gets you into heaven, but that is the sign of a true Christian. The sign of a true Christian is someone who is murdering his sin daily by the Spirit. It doesn't make you a Christian. What makes you a Christian is trusting Jesus died in your place. The evidence that you believe Jesus died in your place, one of them at least, is that you are murdering sin daily. Prayerful reliance, Spirit reliance, and gospel reliance.